Thanks, Ryan. I really appreciate you guys taking the time out today. Your time is precious. I value that investment. I consider it an honor to talk to you all, interact with you all today. I remember every coach I ever had playing football, baseball, golf, growing up. They had both positive and negative influences on my life. But I can tell you the characteristics of every one of those coaches. You guys have a tremendous opportunity to influence the lives of the children that come around you, and they'll remember you for the rest of their lives, believe me, just like me. And they'll remember what you were like and how you influenced them. So because of that, I love to talk to coaches. I've been coaching my own children and other children. I've coached baseball. I've coached basketball. I've coached soccer. I've coached golf. I coached fast pitch softball when I was in college. I went to a college that actually had fast pitch softball as an intramural sport. I thought softball, because I was a baseball player, was a wimpy sport. And that slow pitch was not something I ever wanted. And then we played fast pitch, and that was such a fun game. I don't know, anybody ever played fast pitch softball? It's a great sport, primarily because a pitcher with a softball can make a ball move much more than a pitcher with a baseball. It's unbelievable to watch a really good fast pitch softball pitcher. But it was a fun, anyway, but that, just to give you a little bit of idea, I've coached a lot. That doesn't mean I know a lot about coaching. That means you just have experiences at different sports, different ages. And again, come to this question today. That's what I want to address. Does God care who wins? Now, it's a very often asked question because of men like him. Who's that, by the way? Yeah, it's Russell Wilson. He plays for the Seattle Seahawks. This is a quote from him after they beat the Packers in the 2015 NFC Championship game. They came back in the fourth quarter in a very, very dramatic way, from way behind. And so many things happened in that last quarter that were really unusual. In the locker room after the game, he said this: that's God setting it up, making it so rewarding, so special. Now, he's a self-proclaimed Christian, playing against another Christian, self-proclaimed Christian, Aaron Rodgers, who heard about that quote, and on Tuesday night, 2 days later, on his radio program, said, weekly radio program, said this: I don't think God cares a lot about the outcome. So that's two self-proclaimed Christians giving an opposite answer to the question, does God care who wins? It's asked a lot because of that. In fact, it made it to the cover of this well-known religious publication, right? Sports Illustrated. I don't think quite made that. But notice the top article. Does God care who wins the Super Bowl? This was 2013, the week of the Super Bowl issue. On the cover is who? You know who that is? Ray Lewis. You know why he's on the cover? He played for the team that eventually won that Super Bowl, but he also is a self-proclaimed Christian, and several times in both the AFC Championship and in the playoffs, he was interviewed right after the game and either would quote or pull his jersey off, and underneath his jersey would be a shirt that said, "No weapon that's fashioned against us can stand." And that's an Old Testament quote that has absolutely nothing to do with football, but he set it up as if this was now a war between the godly opponent and the ungodly opponent. And so we're the godly team, and therefore we're going to win. And that's why at the cover of that article was that, of that magazine was that quote. The article that they actually wrote really had nothing to do with the answer to that question, unfortunately. It's a good article, but it's not about that. It's called In the Fields of the Lord. It's an article that talks about basically, is Christianity good for the NFL and is the NFL good for Christianity? I quote it all the time. It's an excellent, excellent article. If you want a copy of it, just let me know. I'll be glad to share it with you. But again, lots of people are asking this question. It's asked on publications like this. It's asked on radio programs. It's asked on TV shows. And really, there are three answers, I think, to the question. The question can be either answered yes, no, or I don't know. And so what I want you to think about for a moment is I want you to take those that handout I gave you And at the top of the handout, there's a place for you to vote. Yes, no, or I don't know. I want you to write down or circle the answer that you would have said before you read the book, if you read the book. So I just talked to Stuart, he'd read the book. But I want you to circle, I'm not going to collect these, this is more for your sake. I want you to circle how you would have answered the question before you got introduced to these ideas. Yes, no, or I don't know. Okay? Now, the question is not just a theoretical question, it's a very personal question for me, and it's a very personal question for you all who really care about the end result of the games. It became really clear to me 2 years after I graduated from college, after spending two and a half years in the chemical industry as a chemical engineer. That's what I graduated with, my original education. I decided to pursue a career in professional golf after playing golf 3 years of my college career. Now, I worked on my game for 2 years and went to what was then called tour school. Now, it had nothing to do with any kind of academic at all. It just meant you played for several rounds and then you qualified. The low people qualified. I'm not going to give you the whole story. I'll leave that to reading in the book. But after three rounds of golf, I was tied for 33rd. The top 15 were going to advance. And I went out that day and shot the best round of my life. It was the low round of the day. I ended up tied for 14th with five other guys. Now, if that would have happened 2 years later, we would have all qualified because they removed the playoff from from the rules. But in this year, they still had the playoff in place. So five of us teed off for two spots. And I made a bogey on the first hole, and I walked back to the clubhouse, now not qualifying. And I remember walking back to the clubhouse that day thinking, did God care what happened that day? So many things happened leading up to that particular day, those 292 shots that I had, that could have gone so much either way. Even that last day, I had, just as an example, I had two putts actually come back at me. If you've ever played golf, that's a very significantly deep lip out. Two of them do that. One of them went 90 degrees, and another putt hung on the lip, downhill putt, looking like it was defying gravity. Now, the point of it is, it could have very, in my mind, easily gone either way. Now, when I got back to the clubhouse, I actually called my wife, and I called my wife and asked her that question. You know, Beth, do you think God cares who won today? Do you think it mattered to him? Now, that was an important question for me, guys, because I did not grow up in a Christian home. We did not go to church as a child for me. I never met anybody that told me they were a Christian until I was 22 years old. I know I met Christians, but I never met anybody that said, I'm a Christian. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, still considered part of the Bible Belt. Never knew anybody that claimed to be a Christian until I was 22. And for the first time in my life, I heard that not only was there was a God, I probably would have said, if you'd asked me leading up to that, do you believe there's a God? I would have probably said, sure, I'm an American, aren't I? I mean, you know, doesn't everybody here believe there's a God back in those days? And I might have even said, he's the creator that wound the world up, and now we're over here just doing what we want. That's called a deistic point of view. I didn't know that worldview at that point, name-wise, but that's probably what I would have said at best. So God was over here and I was over here. Those spheres never intersect. And that day, back when I was 22, I met my first Christian. And I'd watched them change right before my eyes. And I basically asked them, what has happened to you? And they told me there was a God not only who existed and who cared about me, but cared enough to have a relationship with me that he'd do anything to remove the barriers that existed in that relationship, including sending his son to die to rescue me from the things that kept me from that relationship. Well, I never heard any news like that before in my life. That was the first time I'd ever heard anything about the purpose of Jesus coming. I thought that's the best news I've ever heard. I decided to become a follower of Christ the next day, and I married that woman 3 months later. So she was my wife. So I'm married to my spiritual mother. Now, I have to be very careful how I say that, because some people get a little uncomfortable. But no, she's been an incredible blessing to me as a result of that. But so now I'm talking to her. This is now 4 years later. And 4 years later, I'm really trying to integrate my Christianity into all of my life. I've been around some Christians who basically, no matter what they did, they saw their life as having influence in the kingdom of God, whether they were lawyers or businessmen or teachers, or it didn't matter. They were trying to fulfill the Great Commission of the kingdom of God in that. So that naturally, okay, God, did you care? And I asked that question that day. Now, I want you to think about you being on the other end of that phone call that day. And I want you to think about, you've got a very new Christian who has just poured out 2 years of his life trying to prepare for something that he felt very guided into in the beginning, from the very beginning, to pursue. And now wants to know, does God care when? And you're on the other end of that phone call. And I want you to think, does your answer, how would your answer impact my heart? Would your answer draw me to God, or would your answer push me away from God? Or would your answer just leave me confused or really not clear on that? That was the challenge that my wife had that day. So since then, I've been on a quest to answer this question. I've studied, I've read, I've talked, I've prayed, and it led me to writing this book. And leads me to being here with you guys today. I'm going to talk to you about three things. First of all, why I don't like the no answer. Secondly, why I don't like the yes answer. And what I think is the best answer. Third, I have pretty deep convictions on all three of those. But let's talk first of all about why I don't like the no answer. Here's a great illustration of the no answer. It comes from John Walters on NBCSports.com. You could find many examples like this. This is just one example. And he quotes another guy from FoxSports.com when he says, "I refuse to believe that God, anyone's God, has a rooting interest in an outcome, in the outcome of something as secular and perverse as a football game." Now, I want you to notice, in particular, this word and this word. Because he's explaining how he views, or how he thinks God views, that sport. It's a very classic example. And in that example, what happens is, he's saying basically God has more important things to worry about, to care about. Sports are insignificant, and therefore don't make the grade. And what you end up with then is this thinking of two buckets. There's a doesn't care and a cares bucket. And what they just said is that my gains go in the doesn't care bucket. Now, they implied that there were some things that do go in the cares bucket, maybe something like world hunger or AIDS, maybe human trafficking, North Korea. But obviously, games and their outcome do not match, do not make the grade. Now, the dilemma with that is, who decides which bucket things go into? Who makes the distinction? Now, some of us might add, oh, well, as Christians, certainly prayer goes in the cares bucket, and church goes in the cares bucket, and my giving goes in the cares bucket. But what about my job? Guys, I've been meeting with men for over 30 years. In 30 years, I've asked them this question. What does God care about with regard to your work? They'll tell me, well, He cares about the people I can reach at work. He cares about the money that I can make and give. He might even care about how I actually work or play. This is a very common one in Christianity. But I've never had one man tell me that the outcome of their work is something God cares about. He doesn't care about that. I've never had one single man tell me that. 88% of Americans would say, my outcome, my gains, God doesn't care who wins. 80% of Christians would say that. Now, what's the problem with that? The problem with that is, if you're my accountant, you better care. If you're my home builder, you better care. If you're my doctor, you better care about what happens. If you don't, I don't want you as any of those. And so now there's a tension between what I care about and what God cares about. So it turns God into this disinterested spectator on the things that are important to us, and it leaves us very confused. Kurt Warner put it this way. He said, "Do I believe that as a son of God, my life is important to me, to him? No question about it. But I don't know exactly that how that fits into winning and losing." He's confused. He's convinced he fits into that, but Philip Yancey, the author of What's So Amazing About Grace and the Bible Jesus Read and Disappointment with God, he says the number one question in all of life is, which bucket do I fit into? Me. Now, he doesn't say it exactly that way. He says, everybody at the bottom of their heart wants to know if they matter to God. Do I make the grade to actually fit into the God cares bucket? I told you that I got married right after I became a Christian. And I grew up very strongly thinking that women were objects to be taken from. That was my worldview. Even after I became a Christian, sex was about me. I remember the day. I was 30 years old. I'd been married for almost 9 years. I was sitting on the bed, getting ready to go to bed, and I remember thinking, you know, Beth's tired. That's my wife. Beth's tired. She probably isn't going to want to make love tonight. I think I'll not initiate sex. And for the first time in my life, my sex got integrated into the God cares bucket. Now, every single one of you struggles with this secular, sacred compartmentalization. Maybe not on the soccer field or on the football field or on the wrestling match or in your workplace, but we're always wrestling with that because, again, we live in a compartmentalized world. People say these things matter to God and these don't. And it leaves us confused. And then what we also do is try to convince God to care about the things that we care about. It puts us in tension. Have you ever tried to get somebody to care about something you don't care about? Maybe it's your wife. Maybe it's your children. Maybe it's the players you coached. That's a hard thing, isn't it? You're trying to pull them to care about something they don't care about. And so if you think God doesn't care about your gains, but you do, now you're trying to convince God to do that. And any of you know who's ever been in that tug of war, you're not going to win that war. And so what it ends up doing is it ends up causing us still to think that God is this disinterested spectator, and we walk away from God. And we leave our gains here. Now that has serious, serious ramifications. The brokenness of sports today is broader and deeper than it has ever been. You have 8-year-olds playing football on steroids. You have fathers of teenagers who drug their son or daughter's opponents. In a broadly known case several years ago, it led to the death of a high school student because he would put barbiturates in the water bottles of his son's tennis opponent. They discovered that what happened was this opponent got drowsy on the way home, fell asleep, and died at the wheel. The man went to jail for a murder. We shake our head. It's hard to believe. We just can't even imagine that kind of brokenness. But that's what happens when we stick it in the doesn't care bucket. Why would we want to put it there? Think about that for a moment. Why would we want to keep it in the doesn't care bucket? Our sports, for instance. Our games, our job, our sex, or whatever. What's the value of keeping it here? In what way? I don't disagree with you.
Well, because you care, but then you think, well, he doesn't care. Well, he still loves me. What's the love of that? So kind of lets him off the hook, lets our face off the hook.
And who else does it let off the hook? Me. Because as long as God doesn't care, then I can what? Say that? Well, I couldn't hear you. Did everybody hear that? I can do what I want with it. I had a gentleman in one of the groups that I led on this topic said the main reason that we want it here is for that very reason. I can keep control of it here. If it goes over here, then I got to start thinking about what God wants. This compartmentalization is very broad and very deep, and it leads to a brokenness in sports because now you've got players that can point to the sky and then can actually taunt the players that they actually just were playing against. Kevin Durant, if you watch him now, when he dunks on somebody, he does this. He was taught by a pastor in New York to do that. And what that means is, in between the lines, I'm going to take you out, but after the game, I'm going to pray for you. Now, your players are watching that kind of stuff all the time. In between the lines, it's said in the NBA, but it's true in all sports. What kind of goes on the soccer field or on the basketball court, on the football, that's like no holds barred. You can do whatever you want, but when you walk off, that's when God kind of, you care about Him. In that article from the Sports Illustrated, on Does God Care Wins, one of the athletes is quoted as saying he's a player at West Point, involved with a Christian organization at the school, well known, and he said, it doesn't matter how I play, I leave God on the bench. God doesn't care about those, so I can leave God on the bench. So what I want you just to see is that's why I don't like the no answer. You end up with this two bucket thinking that confuses us, and we walk away from God, and most importantly, it leaves our sports completely unredeemed to do with what we want. And the idolatry of sports has never been bigger and never been broader than it is today. It's always been there, but it has never been bigger and never been broader. If you don't believe that, talk to me, and I'll show you illustration after illustration of what's going on in the sport world. You know it enough, but if you just need more ammunition to believe that, I can give it to you. So that's why I don't like the no answer. But then, why don't I like the yes answer? Who can tell me who that lady is, by the way? What's her name? Nope, close. Sister is her first name. Sister Jean. Sister Jean. Do you remember who she was the chaplain for? Loyola. Chicago Loyola. Or Loyola Chicago, I think is the right way to say that. She's 96-year-old chaplain for this team. And this was her quote throughout that time. I told them that we were going to win, that we could do it, and that God would be on our side. This team made it unexpectedly to the Final Four. And the sad part to me about it was, after they lost in the semifinals, she went dark. She did not talk to the media. The sports information personnel from the school came out and said she was exhausted from all the social media attention that she got. She actually set the record for bobblehead sales, new bobblehead sales, because of what happened with her. And the sad, now, I don't question her sincerity. I mean, she's a 96-year-old woman who's been involved in Christianity. I don't know anything about a relationship with God. I just struggle when she says that very strongly and then doesn't say anything. Because when she doesn't say anything, she says something. She says, I don't know how to handle this problem, this issue. I'm confused because I thought God was on our side. Now, it goes even stronger than that, though. This is a quote from Austin Colley. He plays for BYU. They beat the University of Utah, their arch rivals, on a 4th-and-17 play in the fourth quarter. Now, look at what he says. When you're doing what's right on and off the field, I think the Lord steps in and plays a part. Magic happens. I had a gentleman just last week. I was in Birmingham. That's where I am now. I was in Baton Rouge speaking to a group of men about this topic. And one of the leaders of that group of men, about 40 guys at this church, said he played. He stood up when we were talking. He said, I played football in high school and college, and I was very involved in a Christian ministry during that time. Again, well-known national Christian ministry. He said, I thought of God as a good luck charm. Just like Austin Collier. I thought if I prayed, if I read, then he'd be on our side. I could get him to win in that state, in that point. Now, the problem with that is it distorts the core message of Christianity, guys. And you know this. I'm not trying to tell you anything you don't already know. But there are five world religions. Four of them are on the left-hand side of this diagram. Four of them say, this is Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, say that the way that you achieve oneness with God is you climb up a stairway of your own works until finally you present those works to God at some point in time and He rewards you with heaven. Now, in Islam, we know that as much, probably more today than we have in the past, because there's a way for a jihadist to immediately make that transaction with God. And what do they do to make that happen? You know? Martyrdom. That's exactly right. They are guaranteed that work God cannot not respond to. He must, at that moment in time, put them into paradise with 70 virgins to then make love to. Christianity stands in direct opposition to that idea. Christianity is not about what I do to climb a stairway to heaven by my works. Christianity is about me, about God descending down into our poverty to lift us out of it. That's why Jesus said at the very beginning of His greatest sermon called the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the what? Remember? Poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. It's poverty that the kingdom of God dwells in, according to Jesus. Exactly the opposite of the four major religions. Other major religions. Now, the product of that is that what we tend to do is view that God rewards the winners with what? Winning. And He punishes the losers with losing. And guys, if you don't think that's applicable, that's exactly what I struggled with for years. What did I do wrong, God, that You didn't reward me? I've worked really hard. See, even though I got introduced to Christianity, I had grown up in a very strongly performance-oriented family. And in my performance-oriented family, if you did well, you got rewarded. If you did poorly, you got punished. And so while I was drawn to the unconditional love of God, I still thought of it as being very conditional. In those days, I struggled for years. What did I do wrong? Because the farther I got away from that, the more closely I realized how I had gotten and missed. And so, this is the product that we end up with. And what it does to God is it turns Him into a genie that we can manipulate. That gentleman said it was a good luck charm to him. God was a good luck charm. Now, it turns the winners into proud people and the losers into humiliated ones. And that's what I told you happened to me. because that's how I thought God worked. And that's how your athletes think God works. Whether they acknowledge that or not, if they are growing up in America today, the whole world in which we live in is transactional. When they go to school, when they work hard, and they get what for as a result of that? Good grades. If they don't work hard, what do they get? Poor grades. And that's the way life is set up, as transactional. And we carry that then over to God and think He's that way. Now, it has bigger implications than just our games, though, because listen to this couple quotes. Somebody just read that for me, would you please? We laugh at it, but that's what really is going on. What are we supposed to do when the opposing team says, we just want to give God the glory for this win? Hopefully. No, go ahead. I wish that video would go as viral as the ones of Dabo or of 2A or whoever it is after the victories. Because those get buried, unfortunately. Right? I'm glad to know that. It just doesn't get broadcast nearly as broadly as the other ones do. Just happened. Yeah. Now, it gets even broader, though. Look at this quote. Somebody read that, please.
If we tell viewers that God's closest equals winning a sports game, our sports fans are supposed to interpret their own private losses. Do they conclude that God must not favor them, or else their lives wouldn't be the equal?
You see, we herald, unfortunately, our culture heralds the guys that win and say we just want to praise God for that. And it tends to communicate this: God rewards the winners and punishes the losers. And that spreads to all of our lives, like in this situation. I had a friend of mine that went through this book with a group of guys. He's not a Christian. He's been examining Christianity for about 6 years with this group. And then I came and went through the book, and he really liked it, and we've been continuing to meet, he and I, since that time, almost a year now. But last spring, do you remember when the Florida school shooting took place? Remember that? Tragic day. We met the Friday after that shooting. I think the shooting was Wednesday. I think it was that Friday. And he got really sensitive because of the book, to how people responded on camera. And he said, Bob, I was watching the coverage, and they had a mom on whose daughter was sitting next to a girl that got shot. Okay? So her daughter was spared. This girl was not. And the mom said these words: we're just so blessed. Now, I don't think she meant that meant the other woman was cursed. But that's how she heard it. God rewarded her with sparing her daughter and punished the other one with the death of her daughter. So that's why I don't like the yes answer. Because the yes answer distorts the primary message of Christianity. It leaves us thinking of God as our genie that we can manipulate. It leaves us thinking proudly of ourselves if we win and humiliated if we lose. And again, we just walk away from a God like that. What do you think that mom, if she saw that news coverage and heard that, what do you think that mom would do in her heart toward a God that she thought was really like that? Yeah, she'd walk away. And I wouldn't blame her one bit. Now, so I told you why I don't like the no answer and why I don't like the yes answer. So now I'm going to tell you what I think is the best answer. And that answer is yes, he cares, but for very different reasons than we care. Very different reasons. Now, we got to think, first of all, about why we care. Why did I care that day? In Florida back in a long, long time ago. I did. Toward what end? Toward glory. Toward glory. Glory in this idea of there's two concepts, and this is true in our culture, it's also true biblically. Glory can either mean this inherent greatness, or it can mean the outer recognition of that inherent greatness. That inherent greatness or the outer recognition of that. Now, I wanted my glory, my inherent greatness to be recognized by people and so that they would say to me, that guy's good enough to make the PGA Tour. That's why I cared. Now, before we condemn that idea, I want you to recognize that the Bible affirms that. In this verse in 1 Corinthians, Paul is saying, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do it all for the glory. If you just stop there, he acknowledges that everything we do is for the establishment of our greatness and therefore for the recognition of that. The issue is not whether we do it for the glory. The issue is whose glory we do it for. And he's saying, don't change your motivation for glory in the sense of get rid of that motivation. It's just redirect the motivation. Now, why is that true about us? Because it's true of God. John Piper puts it this way, God's first commitment is to his own glory. And this is the basis of ours. God's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy his glory forever. That's a rephrasing of what's known as the Westminster Catechism statement, what's the chief end of man, which is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. The point of that is, the reason that's our chief aim is because that's God's chief aim. God's chief aim in all of life is about his glory. And it originally was our chief aim. I've come to the point that I recognize that the gospel is a story of glory. It's a four-chapter story, creation, fall, redemption, consummation. In creation, he gives us glory. The heavens declare the glory of God, it says. They recognize his greatness. They declare that. So he made all that there is around us in the days of creation. And then he came to the sixth day and he said, but we're going to do something different with man and woman. We're going to make them in our what? In our image and in our likeness. We're going to give them an inherent greatness that is different from the rest of all creation. No tree, no sun, no bird, no animal, no Grand Canyon. Nothing is like a human being. And they're going to express that greatness when he says in the Dominion Mandate, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, subdue it. So that my greatness, God's greatness, is then expressed and honored in all creation. He gave us that glory. Unfortunately, we decided to rebel against that plan. And when we did, we lost glory. Whoops. Sorry about that. And we lost glory in the sense of we lost our likeness. This likeness of being made in the image of God. You all know the Bible verse says Romans 3:23. You know that Bible verse. It says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. At the fall, we fell from our glory. as image bearers. We lost glory. And ever since that day, men and women throughout history have been searching for glory, trying to establish again their inherent greatness so that its outer recognition would be heralded. We search for it in all kinds of ways. But sports is probably, in my opinion, the greatest illustration of how we do that. We want to hold the championship trophy. We'll set up many different levels of five-year-old soccer so that we can have five different champions. Right? Ryan, I mean, that's what happens. That's not true in soccer. It's not just true in soccer. It's true in every sport today. This is part of the brokenness. But it's so evident, our search for glory. Our search for our inherent, the establishment of our inherent greatness. Now, Jesus came to restore us to glory. The hero of the story arrived, and his purpose in coming was to restore us to glory. I don't know if you've ever thought of it that way, but look at this Bible verse from Hebrews chapter 2. This is just one. There are many other examples of this. It says, "It was fitting that He," that's Jesus, "for whom and by whom all things exist, should make the founder of their suffering, a salvation perfect through suffering." I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought it should be God. It was fitting for He, God, and should make the founder, Jesus, of their suffering perfect, of their salvation perfect through suffering. But notice the phrase in the middle of the purpose of Jesus. "It was fitting for Him in bringing many sons to salvation, to restoring glory." That's the point. It's the purpose of redemption is to restore us to our place of glory as image bearers. Now, we don't find that all completely in this world. We can taste of it, but the promise of heaven has at its core the promise of glory complete. "Christ in you, the hope of glory," Colossians 1 says. Romans 8 says, "If we share in His sufferings, then we will share in His glory." And it goes on to say, we will be released into our freedom, the glorious freedom of the children of God. It's not just God being glorified. We become fully glorified. This is a magnificent story of glory. And so, does God care who wins? Absolutely He cares who wins and how the winning and the losing contribute to His glory. That's the answer. Yes, He cares in the way that the winning and the losing contribute to His glory. Now, what I discovered that changed my life was, as I began to wrestle with Him about this, I realized that God had a greater passion for the outcome of that day back at Tourist School than I ever would. I'm a pretty passionate person. If you get around me very much, you'll notice that. I mean, most people don't say, you know, you got to kind of dial it up, Bob, when you talk. But I discovered my passion was just a drop in the ocean of God's passion for what happened that day and His glory. The issue was not for me to suppress my passion to win or disregard God so I could just let it go free. The issue was for me, just like that verse, to redirect it. Did I care more about my plan to establish glory or about God's plan to establish His glory? And I realized when I got there, guys, I was in the right path. Because then it became a question of me saying to God, "Not my will, but Your will be done. Not my plan to get glory, but Your plan." And I realized that that's exactly what Jesus said in the garden. Now, I'm not trying to imply that any of us have anywhere near the same kind of discussion going on. But when Jesus was in the garden, remember what He said? You know, "Lord, if it's possible, take this cup from me. If You could have a better way to establish Your glory than me dying, Take it away. But, no, not my will, but your will be done. See, the enemy tempts us, just like he did Jesus in the wilderness. I can give you glory here now. The glory, and if you look at that word, here are all the kingdoms and their glory. That's the statement he makes to Jesus. I'll give you those now. And Jesus said, no, I don't want earthly glory. I want heavenly glory. I want the glory that comes from God. And he delays that. And my challenge was just like your challenge is, and that is to accept God's plan as the best for his glory. You know, now, guys, honestly, I wouldn't be here today if I make that tour of school. I wouldn't have written a book, I don't think. I might be in golf ministry. I think I'd probably be in ministry, but I don't think I wouldn't be talking to coaches at a church because I never would have probably been a pastor for 18 years and gained a real heart for the local church. So I can see now later some of the implications of God's choice for my glory and His. Sometimes we don't get that choice or that opportunity to see that, but the challenge is still the same. The challenge is still the same to acknowledge that He has a passion for His glory that far exceeds anything I could ever, ever feel. And He wants to share that glory with me in a way that will melt all of the glories of this world. Piper, again, says it this way. If you can't see the sun, you'll be impressed with a street light. You know, this fluorescent light here is impressive if you've never seen the sun, but you go outside and you look at the real light and you go, that's not light, that's light. Or if you've never been in thunder and lightning, how many, have you ever been in a big storm and it's just rocking the whole house? You go outside, I mean, it's scary. If you've never seen that, an M80 will impress you. But if you've been in a hurricane, you'll realize this is far beyond what you could ever control. And if you turn your back on the greatness and majesty of God, His glory, you'll fall in love with a world of shadows and short-lived pleasures. You'll fall in love with a world of winning here. And you'll miss the all-satisfying, all-consuming glory of God. If your players settle for winning championships because they think God doesn't care or they think they can manipulate Him to get their will accomplished and miss what they could experience of tasting of the glory of God, they lose, even though they might have won in the long term. Now, guys, I'm asking you to think today and make a switch. I'm asking you to switch. If you had in your mind any idea that there were two buckets, to go, there's just not two buckets. If you had in your mind in any way that there, these worldly championships could in any possible way stand next to the glory of God, and you can manipulate God to get you to get those, to get Him to give you those championships, I'm asking you to switch that. I'm asking you to say, there is nothing of greater value for me to pursue than the glory of God. And nothing will integrate my life like that. And the reason I'm asking you to switch that, and to then think about how you might help your players switch that, is when cultures have adopted this idea that the glory of God is worth pursuing in all of life, that they actually go back to this verse and they actually begin to do this, for whatever they do it all for the glory of God. Do you know what's happened? I'll give you one illustration. In the 1500s, there was a very strong secular sacred divide in Christianity because of the Catholic Church and what was going on in the Catholic Church at that time. I'm not trying to pick on the Catholic Church. That's our mother. She's our mother. But at that point, the Catholic Church had a group of people called monks. Now, monks believed in a very strong secular sacred divide. In fact, they thought there were things God didn't care about, like work. So they didn't work. What else didn't they think God cares about? sex. And so they took in marriage. So they said, no, we're going to take vows of chastity. What else? Possessions and money. They said, God doesn't care about that. We're going to take vows of poverty. Now, the rest, so they became the sacred model. You don't have sex, you don't have marriage, you don't work, all you do is pray and read and write. And the average Joe thought what? He didn't matter at all to God. And then a man by the name of Martin Luther came around. And he said, guys, there aren't two buckets. All of life can be lived for the glory of God. And do you know what happened? Stonemasons and farmers and artists and architects and musicians and writers began to think, I'll do whatever I do to show off God, to make Him famous. And you know what it produced? The greatest literature, the greatest music, the greatest architecture. Not just cathedrals, but certainly some of those cathedrals, spectacular things, because men and women began to think whatever they did was worth pursuing for the glory of God. And it brought meaning to everything, including practicing with a group of 17-year-old kids or 14-year-old kids or setting up a practice plan for 10-year-old kids. And so my hope, actually, in writing the book was to start a revolution. Or maybe to help catalyze what's already going on as a revolution. That's a better way to say it. And I'm hoping to produce the greatest sports the world has ever seen. Sports that are actually done for the glory of God. Actually done that way. And so today, I get the privilege of just holding this up to you. That the glory of God is worth pursuing everything of your life in. And it can start with your coaching. Believe God cares about it, not for the reasons that we care about it for our glory, but because it has an impact on His glory. Teach your players to do that. These are some of the things you can do. Let me give you a couple of other ideas. Connect your just first of all, if you in any way have disconnected your competition to God and His glory, don't. Reconnect that. Don't think it doesn't matter what goes on that soccer field or that wrestling mat or that football field. And then acknowledge the frequency and depth with which you and I still pursue our own glory. Guys, you know, this is what the gospel frees us to do. The gospel frees us to acknowledge the depth of our brokenness. We're far, as Tim Keller says, we're far worse than we've ever imagined, far more loved than we've ever dreamed. You don't need to hide that. When I go to play golf now, guys say, oh, it's a lot of pressure to play with you. No, who's the pressure on? Why? I'm supposed to be the old pro. And it can still be very much about me. And the best thing for me to do is just to say, God, thank you that I don't have to cover this up. I don't have to try to climb that ladder with my good works. I can just own that it's still about me today. I'm sorry. Would you change my heart? Would you get my mind and my heart fixed on your glory? Would you give me a taste of that? And that's where you begin to just pray. You just pray that God would begin to show you that deeper taste of His own glory and what it means to compete for that. Then there's one last thing you could do, and that's do something with your players. Take them through the book and the material. We've got study guides available in a 3-week and an 8-week format. They're free. I'd be glad to send them to anybody. Be my pleasure to do that. Because again, what did I tell you I'm trying to do? I'm trying to catalyze a revolution. Because I think that's what God's up to. So hopefully today that's what you've heard. You've heard the glory of God calling to you to integrate all your coaching into His glory, including your winning and losing. And you would see that your joy is what's at stake. Not the joy of winning a championship, but the joy of actually doing whatever you do for the glory of God. Okay? So we want to just take a couple minutes now to just any questions or comments that you got? Yeah.
I've got a question. And this is my story is probably very similar to yours, except
I would say, Stuart, if I understand that correctly, is what do you want to tell kids that tend to use that as a cop-out, Scott's plan? And I would say the glory of God is the only integrating factor that unifies everything in life, including the way they tie your shoes. Notice in that verse it says, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink. That bottle of water that I'm just drinking up there, as minimal as that is, that can be done to the glory of God. And so the first thing I would want to teach children in general is that there's nothing that doesn't matter to God, including the way you play soccer. And so if it matters, then you better think about what God says. And so it says, and there's another verse that says, whatever you do, do it with all your heart. You can't, if you want to glorify God, the way you do that is you give yourself to it. You don't just casually go about it. That doesn't honor God. You don't just play hard. If you look even more closely at that verse, it says invest your heart, not your body. It's not just actually doing your body. It's actually investing all your emotional energy in it as well. Now, at the same time, that'd be the person that doesn't really invest. I would challenge them with the glory of God rather than they don't care about the outcome of the game. And that's why I'm not going to try. Well, that's because you care. You don't care about the outcome of the game, but God does. That's the first thing. Second thing is, I think too often we give intellectual answers without telling people what to do with their disappointment. This is for the person that's tried really hard. If you'd have told me that day it was God's plan when I was walking off the golf course, that wouldn't have satisfied me. Why? Because I felt disappointed at that point. I needed to know that God cared about my disappointment. I needed to know my disappointment, discouragement mattered to God. I needed to know He was weeping with me. It didn't change His will, but He still was weeping with me. Then my heart is drawn to Him to want to see that really He has my good at His heart. Not just His plan, quote, quote. I have a good friend of mine that used to, they would say honestly, until he was 30 years old, he thought God's glory and His good were in opposition to each other. So if you pursued the plan of God, it was actually in opposition to His good. And when he started to study the glory of God and he got unified, he got all of a sudden goes, they're integrated. That's the wonder of them. So yeah, those would be some of my brief answers, Stuart. I don't know if that's helpful.
If we have kids that don't play hard, we'll send them to Jacob.
Very young. That was our first.
Did you? Like you're talking.
My kids, I gave them a son, a junior, played a game the other day, and they lost.
heart set, because he has a heart. And my point for him is, I have to be in there. He gave 100%, he's the best. He gave God the glory there by doing that.
Wow.
So, but because we started out on the losing end of things, I really kind of struggled with some of those things you're talking about here. And what I would tell him before the games, I would say, this is what I really want to see out of you. I want you trying your absolute hardest out there, no matter what, try your hardest. I want you to be listening to your coach, do what your coach says, you be respectful to him, you listen to the coach, and I want you to have good sportsmanship. So,
I think those are great guys. The only thing I would add to that is I want you to be careful that you don't diminish their desire to win and their disappointment to lose, because those are God-given qualities. So I would affirm your son's disappointment. But I didn't think you were saying that, but I'm just talking about in the broader way to go, the outcome mattered to God. And that's why it matters to you. Because it does matter. If you'd have said to me, did you play well today, Bob, on the golf course? Did you honor God? Yeah, but I lost. And I need to know God is alongside my heart that's disappointed. He doesn't push me away and say, don't care about that. He just says, yeah, I'm near to the brokenhearted and save those who are crushed in spirit. You feel crushed right now, Bob? You're near me right now. And I'll, in that relational context, I'll affirm that the win was not as valuable as the loss, but it's in that relational context. Now, here's one other assignment for you, by the way.
Well, if I could ask one thing, please. I'm a teacher input on this, because I've changed my choice of words over the years, basically because of what Steve was talking about. We want them to understand that, you're not defined by whether you win or lose, because you're God's child and you live my life. And it gets to the point where kids are like, well, who cares if you win or lose? So we can't, I've made the transition in my mind where I tend to say, well, it doesn't matter if you win or lose. But, to add the phrase, but it matters greatly if you try to win. Trying to win is very important.
Yeah.
The game is the competition. And so give everything you got to try to win. And so just trying to clearly communicate that concept, the younger the age, the harder it is. But, so you're not thinking you're awesome when you do win, and you're not thinking you're terrible when you do lose, but it's the manner in which you approach it and how you play and like what Eric talked about. And you did everything you did. You played well, you played your heart out. The results, nothing you got.
And you don't give everything to win. That's another point I try to make. I don't cheat to win.
That's a good point.
I had a great example of that when I was in high school, and it was very humbling to be able to tell them about the accident. I took it too. But,
in a football game?
But really, really getting through their brain, do everything you can within the rules of the game to try to win. We deal with a lot of kids that maybe I'll try today, maybe I won't. I still got the wrong mindset.
It's not that big a deal, right? And so that goes back to what Stuart was saying. Everything matters, even the way you tied your shoes today. Well, I had one guy said, "Gosh, if I really embrace that, that would mean I have to think a lot about life." I said, "That's exactly what you got to do. You got to think exactly that way." So.
Good at a youth level. You and I have had this conversation. I know you're much stronger than I am.
right on the field, and you can, but the thing that I think all of us have to recognize is if we're not applying this to our own lives, then the very people that you're trying to instruct, you have crushed their hearts, because they'll see you or they'll hear you react to something that's contrary to what you're trying to get them to understand. Now, there used to be a photo a long time ago in the billboard, and it said, it was a photo of child's face, and it said, in their eyes, Christ looks just like you.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that has always been very effective and accountability to me.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm working with kids or with young people, is that it doesn't matter if I'm having a bad day. It doesn't matter about my personality, if I'm a type D or not. If I respond a certain way, and you've taken on this role of being a leader, then you're held to a higher standard, and you're held to a stronger accountability. And we can't disregard this to our own personal lives as we're coaching on the field or walking around the mall.
Yeah.
And the kids that we're coaching on the field see this in a parking lot or see this blow the horn. Somebody
else Well, and to reinforce your thought there, Scott, every one of us in this room can be honest and say we struggle with a compartmentalized view of life. There are things that, just like we just said, the way we drive, the way we handle our money, I don't know what it is, but every one of you is challenged, and our own brokenness about our lack of integration gives us the humility to stand before the kids and use those examples like Eric did, because that's real life. That's real life. I mean, none of us in this room have arrived at doing whatever we do for the glory of God, right? I mean, I'm continually working at that as I continue to see from the Spirit of God how I still think it's about me and I want to keep it over here in the gut, doesn't care a bucket. So, I mean, I think that humility, talking to the children, no matter what their age is, they'll see that and smell that and taste that to where then they're attracted to that, right? You're struggling with the same thing they are. Are there things that you take off your full effort? There are in my life. I just kind of say, well, I don't need to give my full effort to that.
The convicting thing for me, too, is, you know, how great of a mood I'm in and how great I feel out of the room and how proud I feel. I thought it shouldn't be that way, especially with, you know, 13-year-olds.
Well, guys, I want to respect your time. And again, all the great coaches, you know, I just listened to another great coach recently said, not that I love winning. I hate what? Everybody hates what it feels like. So anyway, thanks for your time today. I have books available. If you don't have a copy of the book, that you can purchase for $9. I got a credit card reader that if you want to pick up one, I'm glad to get that to you. You can help me just get the word out with your players. Again, if you need a copy of the studies, the 3 a week, or my email is bschindler, just my name.
That list there, that information will go up to that list.
It could, yeah, I could do that, yeah. Did everybody get their email address on that? Thank you, that's a better way to do it, Ryan. I'll just send you that out. Yeah, thanks. Let me close this in prayer, could I? Yeah. Father, thank you for these men that were made in your image. That you intend to be shining lights in this world. You rescued them, Jesus, so that they could be restored to glory. You made them your workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, including the coaching of these young men and women that are coaching. Please, God, would you continue to use them for the establishment of your kingdom in the hearts of these kids? Would you open their hearts all the more to your longing for their own glory? To the depth of how you want to share your glory with them, and it would really draw them to you, Jesus, I ask in your name. Amen.